Wisconsin is among 10 states where nitrate contamination is in drinking water and getting worse. Danielle Kading reports that's according to a new study by the Environmental Working Group.
About 90% of nitrate in groundwater can be traced back to agriculture in Wisconsin. Too much nitrate can be harmful, especially for infants under 6 months old. The Environmental Working Group says around 300 community water supplies in Wisconsin had elevated levels. Analyst Ann Schechinger says more than half saw contamination grow over a 15-year period.
We think that we need to have some farm standards. Farmers should really be required to implement some basic conservation practices that can reduce nitrogen runoff.
The Wisconsin DNR has begun drawing up manure spreading restrictions in areas prone to groundwater contamination. The Wisconsin Dairy Business Association says the state should focus on fully applying existing standards for farms. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin residents can now apply for 13 more weeks of unemployment benefits using money from the federal coronavirus relief bill. The State Department of Workforce Development announced Wednesday that Wisconsin residents who have exhausted their 26 weeks of state unemployment benefits can now apply for pandemic emergency unemployment compensation under the bill. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from Focus Features with Irresistible, written and directed by Jon Stewart, a comedy starring Steve Carell and Rose Byrne. Washington, D.C. operatives face off in America's heartland in theaters and on demand tomorrow. More at WatchIrresistible.com.
You're with us for the morning show as we talk about childhood vaccinations amid the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. A drop in pediatric well-check visits has put children behind on their shots, and this could pose a threat as schools and daycares reopen. And it's not just a U.S. problem. The World Health Organization says routine vaccinations have been disrupted in dozens of countries, affecting about 80 million infants. Have you struggled to keep your child on schedule with vaccinations during the pandemic? What decisions have you had to make? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. James Conway is a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's Associate Director for Health Sciences in the Global Health Institute. Dr. Conway, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me back.
Well, as you see this trend from the CDC that vaccinations are falling behind on children, can you tell us anything about what that means, and especially for Wisconsin?
Sure. We're very troubled by this. I think people need to recognize that, you know, when pandemics happen, you know, the general public health systems often are so directed towards a single entity that the rest of the health system seems to fall behind. And, you know, we've certainly seen missed visits for lots of things, but immunizations are one of the most important things we do to protect society as a whole. You know, currently we're seeing in other countries with lockdowns, like Nigeria, you know, a measles outbreak has already started there. And I think people need to remember that during the Ebola outbreaks in both West Africa and the DRC, more people died from measles outbreaks when the public health system fell apart than actually died from Ebola. You know, so when we look here in the United States, we've already been teetering for some years at a threshold as more families question whether they really are going to vaccinate their children. We've already been teetering at maintaining our immunization rates to the level we need to prevent re-outbreaks from occurring. And here in Wisconsin, we've already seen, you know, 20-30% decrease in routine vaccinations for children. So I think people are very concerned what happens when we get back into the fall with school.
And when we get back into the fall with school, what do you see there? What are the threats for exposure as children return to school and return to daycare?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all recognize that children and personal hygiene don't go well together sometimes. You know, I think it's one thing for adults to tell them to stay home when you're sick, wash your hands, keep your hands away from your face, and wear masks. But that's really difficult for children. And schools are a perfect breeding ground. You know, we tell children to share, and unfortunately, they do share organisms quite readily. And if we, you know, continue on this trend we've been on, where we've been, you know, missing opportunities to immunize school-age children, it doesn't take much for disease to get introduced and then spread rather quickly. And so I think we're quite concerned, as we've seen measles over the past couple of years has had some resurgence. You know, mumps periodically re-enters, and we've had outbreaks within Wisconsin over the last 10 years, and then whooping cough and things like that. You know, the other part is that there's many vaccines, pneumococcal vaccine and Haemophilus influenza, which are designed to prevent kids from having invasive disease from organisms that most of us carry. So it's quite likely that if we don't figure out a way to administer vaccines more routinely, that we will see an uptick in many childhood diseases, both common ones like ear infections and sinus infections that are caused by those bacteria, as well as potentially some of these diseases that we've had a better handle on over the last couple of years.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. James Conway, professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're looking at vaccination amid the pandemic. Do you have children? Have they been vaccinated in the last few months? What are you most concerned about when school starts back in the fall? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Conway, you mentioned measles, one of the most contagious viruses, and eradicating measles from a community requires a very high compliance rate, to make sure that you are safe. When you look at outbreaks, whether they be in other parts of the country or here in Wisconsin, what does compliance look like?
Yeah, so if you think about the most recent measles outbreak we had, you know, the hot spots were some of the areas around New York City, as well as some areas in the Midwest and then California areas. They tend to be areas that have immunization rates that are lower than 90%, and in many of those areas, they were lower than 80% of the children were fully immunized. And many of these are populations of certain religious groups that may oppose vaccines. But the problem that you get into is when you have clustering of those populations. And as you mentioned, you know, measles is one of the most contagious diseases we see. So then let's superimpose that on the pandemic. If we look at New York City, where obviously we've had, you know, really dramatic pandemic impact, vaccinations plummeted overall in New York City over just the period from January through April by 63%. And 91% of kids older than two, just were not receiving any vaccines. So this is, you know, in many ways sort of a quiet emergency behind the scenes. And, you know, I think as we're seeing a resurgence of disease, we're starting to see more areas of the country that are going to be struggling to provide what I think we think of as just a safe environment for people's mindset to be willing to come into health centers for immunization. So, you know, in many ways, I think we're concerned that this actually may get worse rather than better.
Do you see healthcare providers, pediatrician offices, do you see them being proactive here, that if this is a silent thing to be very concerned about, what is healthcare saying and doing right now?
Yeah, so I think this has, you know, finally risen to the level of a crisis. And, you know, I think as we've gotten a handle on exactly what it takes to control the pandemic, I think we've seen more and more health centers and states all over the country, as well as professional organizations sort of pivoting and starting to realize that we know how now to manage these things in our health systems. And so I think we feel like we can safely start to ramp back up with routine care. And we've certainly seen that here in the central and southern areas of Wisconsin, that most of the health systems, you know, as May rolled on and we realized we had a better handle on things, have started to reopen. But it's now been a matter of trying to be proactive about reaching out to parents and patients to get them to understand that we feel very comfortable we've got this. And so part of the reason I'm here and talking to you today, and many of my colleagues around the country are doing the same, is to try to encourage both the providers and parents to both be proactive about this. I think parents need to take opportunity to reach out to their providers. And even though not every office may be open and some parents and their kids may be diverted to certain clinics, you know, some of the systems have designed just healthy kid clinics to keep ill people separated from healthy people. You know, I think they need to understand that you know, we're in a new normal for a lot of different things in healthcare. And that may be the new normal that we need to have, is specifically well-child immunization sites where people can go for vaccines. So I think the whole system is realizing we really need to ramp up and be creative about how to approach this.
In terms of vaccines, one physician recently put it this way: patients should be more afraid of the various diseases that vaccines are meant to protect us all against rather than fearing the vaccines themselves. Where does that fear come from in getting vaccinated?
Well, I think, you know, we all are well aware that there's a lot of both social media and internet information or misinformation that's out there that's really sort of scared people on the safety side of things. I think the other part of this is that we've been a victim of our success. And since we have largely controlled a lot of these diseases, it's given more space for people to then worry about the safety side because they're not as afraid of the diseases themselves. So this has been a, you know, an ongoing conversation that we've been having in the U.S. for the last 10 or 15 years. But I think it's a very important thing to readdress as we move forward with this whole current crisis.
Talking about immunization amid the pandemic with Dr. James Conway as our guide. He's a pediatric disease specialist. Your questions about vaccines, they're welcome. Are you keeping your child out of the pediatrician's office during the pandemic? Is this affecting their routine shot schedule? What questions do you have about when immunizations are given and how they're given right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Conway right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how kids are falling behind on their shots during the pandemic. And even before the pandemic, states struggled in getting mandatory immunizations like measles, like mumps, into children, according to federal data. And some public health departments were battling the highest measles tallies in decades. So how are you handling your child's shot schedule? Have you opted for a vaccination exemption? Pediatricians, how do you talk with your families about vaccinations during the pandemic? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. James Conway stays with us. He's the Associate Director for Health Sciences at the Global Health Institute at UW-Madison. Dr. Conway, you know, I'm a parent, and I know there is a lot of fear among parents to how do we keep down risk? And certainly we've been watching the news and the MIS-C, the multisystem inflammatory syndrome, and what COVID can do to kids. What would you say to parents who are really concerned about making sure that they limit their child's exposure?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think everybody's still struggling with this. You know, I think there's a couple of concepts and ideas that people have come up with to try to manage this new normal. You know, one is the idea of these quarantine bubbles of, you know, establishing a network of sort of trusted friends and family that, you know, people all are on the same page as far as how they're behaving and acting when they're out in public. And so you're seeing, you know, the equivalent of sort of these quarantine play groups where families that have all agreed, like, we're going to all be careful, we're going to wear masks when we're out, we're going to, you know, be very cognizant of illness, you know, we're going to function in a way that we can sort of expand our own family into kind of an extended family. And so you're seeing these groups that are coming together in that thoughtful way. And I think that people are sort of hoping and sort of planning on projecting that then into school. And a lot of schools are then talking about, instead of the past practice in schools of kids, you know, changing classes every period and with a different group of kids every hour, you know, the idea is then creating these bubbles of kids that are basically together, but a smaller group, so a smaller number of exposures throughout the day. If one of those kids then does come down with an illness, at least the isolation, you know, is limited to then a smaller group of kids. So I think that's the type of things people need to think about. The other is that I think people do need to, you know, really emphasize what, you know, mom and grandma always told us about hygiene, and really trying to impress upon kids that hand hygiene and these kinds of things are, you know, really, really critical. And then, in fact, they're really important for protecting against a lot of different diseases. You know, one of the most interesting things about the whole quarantine lockdown, as people call it, that we've gone through with the pandemic, is that, you know, you go from March, where we had a decent amount of RSV and influenza circulating in the community, and, you know, the way we closed the state down, those diseases just completely vanished. So within a couple of weeks, the only virus we had circulating was COVID-19. So I think we've shown that it's possible to control respiratory viruses But I think people need to be really thoughtful and think about these ideas of these quarantine bubbles, both, you know, in their schools and also in their social lives in general.
Well, what you say there, even on a micro level in my family unit, I could see it there. When we were under stay-at-home orders and no one going out, suddenly no one had any type of cough or illness. I mean, usually some person has a little bit of some type of gunk. So, I mean, you can even see it in a family unit. And going forward, would you suggest those, you know, thinking more about bubbles and trying to align with making groups together who are all operating under the same scenarios?
Yeah, it seems to be very successful. And I really encourage families, you know, especially those that are, you know, thinking hard about what fall is going to look like, to be proactive with the daycares and the schools where their kids go, and, you know, find out exactly what the plan is and push. You know, I think it's the same way that the health system has been pushed. You know, how are we going to respond and make sure that we can guarantee safety? And I think we've done really a very remarkable job of you know, kind of changing our practices in a way that has really, you know, to be honest, as a citizen, but also as a physician, you know, the places I actually feel safest are when I'm in the hospital and the clinics, because I know how careful everybody is being, and I know how we're screening everybody as they come through. And I think that, you know, could be achievable as long as people continue to maintain this really thoughtful approach to things. And the other is, you know, continuing to communicate. So we've certainly seen our own friends and neighbors, you know, be able to maintain this kind of bubble idea. And so there are, you know, groups within my neighborhood where, you know, you sort of stop and pause when you see it, but there's relatively decent sized groups of kids. But when you talk to the families, they are very careful about, outside of that bubble, where do they go and how do they behave when they're in those places?
We're talking with Dr. James Conway, professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And you can join in. Do you have children? How are you operating in these months during COVID-19 with their well check visits and their vaccinations? Have you reached out to your pediatrician's office? What do they say? And what are your concerns about fall and about exposure and how schools will proceed? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Conway, as we all know, there isn't a vaccine for COVID-19, and it's going to take a long time. No one knows how long. What are health professionals doing to prepare for the implementation of an eventual vaccine? How do you go about figuring out where it goes and how children play into this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we've had a lot of meetings and discussions about how to manage this. You know, I think there's a couple of things to think about. You know, one is going to be that as these vaccines are developed, you know, there's certainly not going to be an abundant quantity of them initially. And so I think there is going to be a need to try to channel them into the highest risk populations, but also making sure that we minimize any safety concerns. And so I think there's a lot of discussion about that. And, you know, as far as implementation, we actually have both models and actually experience with this. You know, every year we have to do flu vaccine, and flu vaccine is going to be particularly important this year, and I think we can talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, every year we sort of ramp up these very intense, you know, over a 2 to 3 month period, administration of vaccines to a really broad portion of the population. I mean, I think last year, you know, the pharmaceutical industry made about 166 million doses of vaccine, and most of them were used. So that means we basically immunize about half the country every fall. So I think we have a model for how to do this, and that's basically the model that we've been using. And if, you know, people think back in 2009, when we had the influenza H1N1 pandemic, you know, we were fortunate there that we already knew how to make flu vaccines. And so we were able to come up with a vaccine for that disease. And that was basically the strategy, was all hands on deck to make vaccine available and to offer it in as many creative ways as possible. And so for that, because it was free and provided by the government, you know, we were able to do it in schools and a lot of other settings. So I think flu vaccine is going to be the model that we use in getting it out there. But like I said, you know, I think everybody realizes that in the beginning, the quantities are going to be limited, no matter how optimistic people may try to be, you know, in the media and in the government. You know, this is going to be a slow process. And so the very interesting and difficult conversation is going to be that if you think about how vaccines are tested, you know, they're mostly tested in healthy individuals, young adults, usually males, you know, 18 to 45 years of age. Yet the highest risk population are obviously people over the age of 60 and people with other comorbidities, other underlying medical conditions, who are usually excluded from those tests and trials. And so I think there's going to be, you know, interesting conversations about how much data do you need to justify saying that this is good enough data to try to get the vaccine out to those high-risk populations. So lots of different conversations around this topic.
And when you talk about the flu vaccine and just the sheer number of people seeking those vaccines, whether it is in their primary care physician's office or in the corner drugstore or right on the middle of a college campus, I remember the scene. I walked out of my building last August, I believe it was, and there was just this long line wending around the block. People were lined up to get their flu shots. So I'm wondering, in how we deliver flu shots this season, what are public health officials thinking about in the delivery to make sure that people are spaced out and they're getting them in ways that are safe and easily accessible?
Yeah, great question. So I think there's two pieces of that. One is the pharmaceutical companies are really making every effort to get the vaccines out early this year. And so I think we've got so far good signals that much of the vaccine may be available as early as the end of August. And so I think part of the idea is going to be, while we're still in, you know, what seems to be, at least in many areas of the country, a summer lull in the waves of pandemic COVID-19, to take advantage of those well periods. And so trying to start immunizing as soon as possible, as early September, I think is really the hope for a lot. That way there can be a little bit more stretching out of the offerings of the vaccine beyond just the usual kind of mid-October through November that most people get the vaccine. The other, though, is that there is going to have to be very thoughtful planning instead of having mass congregation and figuring out ways to do sort of organized periods of time rather than walk-ups. You know, I think it's in many ways may work the way a lot of us work picking up takeout food during the pandemic, where you're given sort of a window after you order your food, like, okay, your food will be ready between 7 and 7:30, so they don't have everybody clustering outside the restaurant all at the same time. You know, I think we may end up doing something similar for flu. The other is they're you know, people are pursuing and looking at the options of things like drive-up, you know, like we've done for testing. Could you actually do drive-up clinics?
Dr. James Conway is with us as we talk about childhood vaccinations, flu season, how parents should approach visits, well check visits, immunizations during the pandemic. Lots to talk about. Was there a measles outbreak in your child's school in recent years? Did you worry about exposure? What guidance are you receiving from your school now on vaccinations as the fall grows near? Have you received an email? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back with Dr. James Conway right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on childhood vaccinations and news that children are behind on their shots due to the pandemic. That's true here in the U.S. and in dozens of countries. Last year, the World Health Organization listed vaccine refusal as one of the top 10 global health threats. And doctors writing in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, they're worried that parents who are hesitant to vaccinate will be just as opposed to a coronavirus vaccine once it's available if the process appears rushed. So what are you thinking about your child's vaccinations? What do you want to know from the pediatric disease specialist? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And Dr. James Conway stays with us. Dr. Conway, let's look at children who are immunocompromised, immunosuppressed, and what their conditions, what their little systems, how are they different when they are attacked by viruses like the flu or like COVID-19? What do you see?
Yeah, you know, there's so many different types of immune compromised conditions now that there's, you know, really a wide spectrum of how kids are affected by these things. You know, depending on which parts of your immune system are compromised, you may not actually have a different experience than a person with a normal immune system. But there are certainly some kids that are at significantly higher risk that just don't have the immune response. in kids, you know, in general, the primary disease itself, you know, the respiratory version of COVID-19 is actually relatively mild for most kids. You know, those that get severely ill the same way adults do with, you know, severe pneumonia and then often impact of their heart, their cardiac system, because of the particular type of inflammation and then clotting that happens along with this. And so, you know, the kids.
Oh, I think we just lost you there.
The same version that an suffer a worse version are going to have the same adult. Uh-oh. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yes.
Okay. Darn technology. So, you know, I think that, you know, in general, I think that we do worry that they're just going to end up with illness that's similar to what the severely affected adults potentially could get, you know, and end up on ventilators and potentially worse than that.
Well, Natalie wrote in to say, my pediatrician, Greg Moyer, at Lake Country Pediatrics in Oconomowoc, has created a mobile clinic to continue to complete well checks and administer vaccines. And Natalie writes, we had the minibus come to our house so our one-year-old and four-year-old could stay on their vaccination schedule. So this is a really creative solution here. Dr. Conway, what do you think?
Well, I think somebody gets a gold star for the day, because I think that is one of the more creative things that I've heard about. But I think that goes to show you how strongly most people in the primary care field feel about how important vaccines are. You know, I think that Detroit, where I wonder what's wrong here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Yeah, carry on.
You know, I think if you see areas like Detroit that were heavily impacted. And you know, we're less than half of kids now, less than 2 years of age, are up to date with their vaccines. I think that, you know, we're going to need to be creative. You know, it may not be the most efficient way for some areas of the country to have mobile clinics, but that's the type of stuff I think people need to do, is think outside the box. You know, in the bigger cities, I think one of the more successful things has been having these dedicated clinics, or at least dedicated half days, where the whole building is reserved for only well visits. And where people are, you know, screened very carefully. I think that that's probably going to be the most normal way of doing things. The other is that there are, you know, clinics that are big enough where they can have just a single entry point.
And I think we're
building for illness.
Yeah, and you know, these mobile clinics, that takes funding and infrastructure. You can't just have a minibus at your disposal in your small community, you know, pediatrics clinic. I would imagine that requires a lot of planning and funding.
Yeah, and I think funding is really going to be the limiting factor for a lot of those kinds of things. So I think it's going to be, you know, largely a matter of trying to take the known existing system and tweaking it in a way that is efficient, but also continues to maintain the safety that we've figured out how to do related to the COVID exposures. So, like I said, I think this is a very achievable thing. I think it was understandable that, you know, temporarily we hit pause on everything while we were figuring all this out and getting testing to be available. But I think now that we figured that out, you know, it's all hands on deck and getting everything back up and running as soon as possible. You know, and we really do need to move quickly, because we've lost, you know, 4 months of routine vaccine. So if you look at like a city like Detroit, I mean, less than half.
And we're having trouble hearing Dr. James Conway. Dr. James Conway is with us. We're going to try to get him by phone here. He's a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And we're looking at childhood vaccinations amid the pandemic. Was there a measles outbreak in the school your child attended within the last few years? Did you worry about their exposure? What advice did you receive from your administration, from your school? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Conway, now that we have you on the trusted old phone, can you tell us what was happening in Detroit? That's where we lost you.
Yeah, so, you know, in Detroit, I mean, obviously they had a pretty significant and severe outbreak. And so less than half the kids under the age of two now in that entire community are up to date with their routine vaccines. So, you know, you forecast that forward into any area that's having a significant outbreak where they really do have to put all their efforts into the COVID management. And you could see that we could really start to have these blossoming areas of under-immunized kids. And I think that's one of the things we really need to be most aware of. And what we learned in the measles outbreak was, it's, you know, even though your national numbers or your state numbers may suggest that your community immunity is okay, it's not homogeneously distributed. And so when you get these pockets of areas where there's going to be under immunization, that's the areas then where outbreaks are going to happen. And so I think we have a lot of concern in Milwaukee, where things have been, you know, significantly affected and was already an area where, you know, many communities had access issues. You know, we know that there is inequities in how the health system reaches a lot of populations. You superimpose those same populations being the ones that are most affected by COVID. And, you know, that's really where we're seeing this, you know, almost an injustice in the inequities of how healthcare is being delivered. So not only do we need to be creative about reaching and pivoting for the routine care, but we actually need to be more proactive about reaching out to those communities that have sort of taken a double hit on all of this.
Right, because some families may say, I can't afford to go to the doctor, or, you know, that doctor visit is going to have a copay. How will I pay for that now that we're out of work? Those are real issues.
Yeah, fortunately, we do have a fairly strong social safety net, at least around vaccines. So vaccines are really considered, you know, so important and have been prioritized at such a level that the Vaccines for Children program, you know, provides free vaccines for underinsured and uninsured populations. And the Affordable Care Act does mandate that vaccines have to be covered within all existing insurance. But it is certainly, you know, very concerning that, you know, so much of our population have their healthcare insurance tethered to their jobs. And when they lose jobs, you know, there's a shift that has to happen for people to be able to get into the Medicaid and Badger Care systems. And so, you know, we understand that that's really a challenge. And, you know, fortunately, the Vaccines for Children program exists and is available at both county health departments as well as, you know, all the major health systems. And so I think people need to be understanding and be proactive that if they do lose their primary insurance, at least vaccines are still fully covered and their eligibility is a rolling thing. It's not open just certain times of the year.
Yeah, and certainly if there is a gap in coverage, as you mentioned, that this is rolling, and you know, even if you have a gap in your working situation and your own health insurance, you don't have to wait. You can still get these vaccines.
Correct. At least for kids under the age of 18. For older, you know, other individuals, adults, you know, it's a little bit more challenging. They do have to get into a formal Medicaid arrangement and go through the process of that. But vaccines for kids are really considered such a priority by our entire country that, you know, we fortunately have the safety net for them.
I want to talk to you about these pockets you see in various cities or in, you know, communities where there isn't that herd immunity or there isn't a high vaccination level. How micro can you get? I mean, how much can you drill down on the data to know where these pockets exist and who might be exposed?
Yeah, well, we're fortunate in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Immunization Registry is one of the oldest and probably the best of the immunization registries that exist. You know, the vast majority, over 95% of the population, are in the registry and have their vaccines recorded. So, you know, we're fortunate that when that was created back in the 90s, that it was created in a way that it can be queried by a provider. Parents can, you know, look at their own children's immunization records there. And so it does allow for public health initiatives because you can look at things by zip code, by county, by provider, by health system. There's really a lot of different ways to look at it. And so it does allow us to, you know, in a de-identified way, you know, everybody's privacy is certainly protected, but we can at least see where the communities are, where there are groups missing certain vaccines, and then hopefully use that as a mechanism to reach out and help those people have better access.
Should we be concerned about pockets where there may be a lack of immunizations? Is this an issue in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, we have, you know, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services has, you know, some very nice websites with maps where you can literally look, you know, anybody in the public is welcome to look and see which counties have better and worse immunization rates. And it's, you know, pretty clear that we have a lot of different challenges in different parts of the state. I mean, we have, you know, urban areas and the inequities that happen with some racial groups in having access. We have rural populations in some places where there aren't readily available vaccines. We have, communities where there's large groups of people that have all shared and convinced themselves that opting out of vaccines makes sense to them. And those are the areas that we are most concerned about when you have the ability for a disease to not only be introduced in an individual to get sick, but the likelihood that they come into contact with others that may be vulnerable as well.
Dr. James Conway, our guide, a UW pediatric disease specialist, have you opted for a vaccination exemption for your child? What's behind your decision? How do you feel about a coronavirus vaccine once it becomes a reality? There's still time to talk with your questions, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Conway right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. All vaccines have one main goal. They prepare a person's immune system to fight off an invading organism should the body encounter it, right? We're talking about childhood vaccinations as Wisconsin and other states prepare to reopen schools this fall. Children who are behind on their shots could pose a threat to themselves and others. What do you want to know about vaccinations and what they do in the body? What is your experience with your child's well-check visits during the pandemic? Did they get a drive-up vaccination? Was there a mobile clinic that came to your house, perhaps? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Dr. James Conway, professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He stays with us. Let's take a call now. Steve is joining us from Wausau this morning. Hi, Steve.
Yes, I'm sorry. I came into the show a little late. Just wondering about vaccine for adults, the pneumonia. Does that need a booster? And also like shingles and tetanus. Do those need booster shots down in your life?
Thank you, Steve.
Great. Yeah, good question, Steve, and thanks for calling in. So, you know, one of the things we have seen is that there's a lot of adults in the older ages that have also been missing vaccines. You know, the shingles vaccine is basically two doses. And, you know, if there was a pause in your stretch of those two doses, you don't need to restart the series. You can just get that second dose whenever you can find a pharmacy or a health provider that can do it. The pneumonia vaccines are interesting. They're actually in evolution right now. And so they're, you know, as people are probably aware, we've had the old Pneumovax vaccine for many years. And then for some time, there was a newer vaccine, PCV13 or Prevnar, originally designed for children, but people realized it could boost the immune response for some older adults. Was used routinely for a little while, and then the benefit kind of wore off because we got rid of those organisms in much of the population by immunizing the kids so well. There's newer ones coming. There's a PCV15 and a PCV20 on the horizon. So I think pneumococcal vaccines are going to change a lot over the next couple of years. And I do anticipate that there are going to be some adults that have already received one of those pneumonia vaccines that are going to be recommended to get one of those new ones, probably. Tetanus, you know, everybody needs a tetanus shot every 10 years. And so no matter what your age group is, that should be something on your horizon. There's a regular tetanus shot called the DT vaccine. And then I think most people are aware of the Tdap vaccine that not only gives you tetanus and a little bit of diphtheria immunity, but also gives you booster on your whooping cough. Recently, the decision was made that those are interchangeable. And so now you're seeing more and more adults who are getting their every 10-year tetanus shot. They'll get that Tdap version of it. So they're actually getting a little bit of whooping cough boost as well. So the answer, shorter answer is yes. There are definitely boosters required for tetanus. You need to complete a two-dose series of shingles, and then we'll see how pneumonia vaccines pan out. But I'm going to anticipate that many people are going to be needing more of those in the coming years.
Steve, thanks for the question. So, Dr. Conway, when you look at boosters here, and I just want to make sure we're clear that, you know, even a booster for HPV, human papilloma virus, that booster is supposed to come within that year, but if it falls with, you know, if it falls later, you don't have to restart it?
Correct. So, you know, the idea with vaccines is the first dose for most vaccines sort of teaches the immune system and kind of tricks it into thinking it's had a disease. And then boosters just periodically are reminding the immune system to don't stop remembering about this disease that's out there. You know, and as science marches on, you know, I think people need to understand that, you know, vaccines, once they're developed, it doesn't stop there. They're monitored very aggressively and for long periods of time to see how long the immunity lasts. And so I think many people, you know, can remember when the chickenpox vaccine came out, and it was initially just one dose, and then people realized that, you know, a second dose was needed, and so that was sort of added into the schedule. So that's how all vaccines go. I'm not going to be surprised at all with COVID-19. At best, I think initially when and if vaccines are developed, they're going to be kind of like flu vaccines, where they're going to need to be, you know, updated or boosted each year. I don't think we're going to immediately have a vaccine that gives long-lasting immunity. And those are things that just need to be sorted out over time. So, you know, as we continue to monitor these things, then we sometimes find, okay, this vaccine actually does need to be boosted periodically. So for HPV, you know, once you get your two doses, as long as you started before the age of 15, currently we think, okay, you're good. But people are continuing to watch that to see would there ever be a reason to give people boosters later in their life.
So vaccines, it's not like, you know, there's really a monitoring as more and more people get them, you get more and more data.
Correct. And so there's a lot of different ways that's done. But I think people need to be very reassured that, you know, one of the great things about the U.S. system is that the FDA mandates that there be long-term monitoring for any kinds of side effects, as well as does there need to be any kind of boosting. So I think we're very fortunate that we've really developed a very robust system for monitoring the two critical pieces, which is, are they safe and are they effective? I mean, that's really all you need to think about when you're thinking about vaccines. You know, do they work, and is it okay to get it? And, you know, we really, in the United States, focus so much on the safety side of it because of the fact that we've managed to control a lot of these diseases. So we've got to be darn sure that a vaccine is safe. And we really, I think, are beneficiaries of a really, really strong system in that way.
We're talking with Dr. James Conway, professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're looking at vaccinations this hour and what to do amid the pandemic. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, earlier in the conversation, you said you feel so safe in hospitals and clinics because there is a lot of testing that's going on and that the healthcare professionals are taking a very, very careful steps with PPP, or I'm sorry, with personal protective equipment and so forth. How can you relate that then to parents and to patients who are not going in and out of those hospitals and clinics every day because they have a much more scarier depiction right now?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, I think one of the things that people need to recognize is that we're all individuals that are in this together. And, you know, from a healthcare standpoint, you know, we care about ourselves and protecting ourselves. And so I think we've worked out, you know, very nicely a system for how things work as far as our interactions with the public, because we care about ourselves, but we care about our patients just as much. And so what we've realized is that by just simple symptom screening, you know, and for anybody that's been in the health system in the last couple of months, I think people are used to now the registration system is usually a phone call ahead of time before your visit, checking to see if you've got any symptoms that could be COVID. And then again, being checked as you come into the building, often getting your temperature taken. And then on top of that, everybody wearing masks. And so the number of episodes where anybody's actually contracted COVID within any hospital system is vanishingly low, you know, almost none, because we've been able to work out this system. And it gives us, I think, some optimism that, you know, the way we're going to really primarily control this is by people managing their space and their hygiene. And I think we've demonstrated that that's very feasible and works very well. So I think people should be absolutely comfortable that we've got this, as we say. We've got a system, and we've demonstrated over and over again over these last months that it works for us as health providers and it works for our patients and their families.
In our last minute together, I'm wondering, if we know so much about vaccines and what they do, why can't we make them faster and get them out there faster?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is making sure that we're careful on the safety side of things. I think we want to know that, you know, there aren't short-term reactions, but we also need to know that there aren't reactions that develop weeks or months later. But the other part is that when you think about a vaccine, you don't only want it to work today and tomorrow, you want it to work for months. And so I think that's going to be the balance that we're going to need to reach with the COVID vaccines, is knowing that we ideally would like these to last for a long time, but at least knowing that they last for some months is going to be important before we start using the health system to broadly administer these.
Well, Dr. Conway, thank you for joining us. Thanks for taking the time, and stay well.
You too, Kate. Always a pleasure.
Dr. James Conway is a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Just ahead, it is On Point, looking at police training in America. How do you fix the system? On Point looks at the training of officers and what goes into it. That is next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.